Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Tina Horn, and this is Interrobang. Interrobang is the bonus segment of my Wire People Into That podcast. Follow at Tina Horn Sass or at Tina Horn's Ass, if you're nasty, on Twitter and Instagram. Visit wirepeopleintothat.com. Support my show and get extra shit at patreon.com/TinaHorn. That's patreon.com/TinaHorn.
Mickey Maud, hello.
Tina Horn, hello.
It's nice to see you.
It's nice to see you as well, old friend.
Yes. You are very special because you are one of the only people that I have had back on the podcast for a return visit, Sloppy Seconds.
I love Sloppy Seconds, and I love being on the show, so I'm glad that I get to be here.
So I'm excited to do an Interrobang with you. I'm excited to be in Austin. I have not spent that much time here, so it's very nice to be, you know, driven around by you. You're showing me where the taco places are, where the swimming holes are, where the, like, outdoor bars are. Pretty great. It's been pretty great.
Austin is a great city. If you like tacos, beer, and swimming, Austin is quite a good place to be.
You know you're singing my song. So there are a couple of things that we are going to talk about today. I think that the focus is going to be on the documentary that you are in the process of making with your partner, who we're going to call M for today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the concept behind that documentary and where it's at?
Absolutely. For those who are listening who don't know who I am,
tell the people who the hell you are.
Background, like, why I'm on the show twice. For those who didn't hear me on the first episode, I am an adult performer.
Sorry, will you start again? I hit the mic with my Topo Chico.
I am an adult performer. I've been performing in adult films for 9 years now. I realize that. Mostly kink and BDSM content, but also kind of a range of content from the span of erotica to hardcore pornography. Sites like Evil Angel, Four Chambers. My partner and I have been together 6 of those years. Mm. Currently, the way that we kind of navigated how we talked about the work that I do, generally, you know, for socially, it was kind of like on a case-by-case basis. Like, oh, this person is cool. I think we can share this with them. And when it came to family, there are some people in my family who know what I do and have no problem with it. And there are some people in my family who, for reasons that I can go into later, we decided not to tell because it just doesn't really serve anything. And for my partner, you know, I was already performing for 3 years before we met. Mm. And upon kind of discussing about how we would talk about what I did for a living, we made the decision not to tell my partner's family. And as, you know, kind of years went on and they got to know us, and that was the impetus of not telling them, is that we didn't want any sort of stigma or preconceived conception about what goes on or what people think goes on in adult entertainment to kind of be a barrier from them getting to know me as a person who is
has other qualities besides your job.
Yeah. And very recently, they have found out what I do for a living, and not through us telling them. We don't know how they found out.
That's really hard.
Yeah. And they have decided to cut off all contact with us. So that has been understandably really difficult for us, really difficult for my wife. And this happened in January. It's June now.
Okay, so it's really still very fresh.
Yes, it is very fresh. And also later in the month of January, actually, no, it was February.
It was February.
It was February where we found out that we are pregnant with our first child.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, you're very excited. But that is also information that we haven't been able to share with them.
Oof.
Because they are not communicating with us at all.
And so that's what the movie's about.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we had my partner is a filmmaker, and we had long kind of talked and had, you know, other friends of ours who were filmmakers ask us, when are you guys gonna make this movie about, like, you know, the kind of your relationship? And I think there's, as you know, there's a lot of fascination in telling the story of sex workers and their partners, and how do people make this, you know, this wacky crazy thing work?
Well, it's exciting to have the opportunity to tell that story on your own terms.
Yeah.
For, like, with your own subjectivity.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that I feel is ever increasingly important. Mm. We talked about this before, the I dated a sex worker sort of story.
Yeah.
That kind of focuses on, like, oh, like, you poor brave thing, like, you were able to love the unlovable. Sort of narrative that kind of goes on, and the, you know, well, diamond in the rough sort of mentality.
Well,
that those
and also,
stories are,
it's the safari narrative, right, where the person telling the story is not the person of interest, but then they do end up being the person that the reader or the viewer is supposed to emotionally connect to, and then the person of interest, the porn star in this case, or in other cases it might be the trans person, or, you know, any other marginalized person that people have, like, a fascination with, but also seeming inability to treat them with humanity or give them human rights. Anyway, then all of a sudden it becomes about the person who is gazing at them and not the person themselves. And we're tired of that.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just a little.
Yeah. And, you know, through, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about this project and how we kind of feel about putting ourselves and our lives out there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are people who will see whatever we decide to put out there and make their judgments one way or the other about, you know, the type of relationship that we have, about the work that I do, about, you know, manipulation and exploitation. And, and there, those people are going to have those thoughts regardless, no
true.
Matter who it is out there.
That's true.
I think that what is important and something that you don't see with documentaries and work that is surrounding sex work is I think people want to focus on, like, the work. You know, people want to focus on, like, being on set and seeing the, you know, the world of, like, here's a glimpse into this world. But that is really such a small part of the relationships and the community.
Mm.
And I think when I see films like Hot Girls Wanted or After Porn, I always feel that what is really lacking from that is the community that people come into around sex work, and the kind of shared similar stories. You know, as I've, you know, let people know who are my friends and through sex work, so many people have similar stories of, you know, coming out to their parents about the work that they do, and being ostracized or disowned. You know, people trying to take their children away and in custody battles with, you know, ex, you know, co-parents and what have you. So many people have a family member or someone in their lives that is choosing not to understand or even consider or even ask about the decisions that they've made with their life, because there's such a strong narrative that we are unable to make decisions for ourselves.
Well, and documentaries, if you can even call them that, like Hot Girls Wanted, I think contribute to the ideologies that then contribute to stigma and contribute to people who don't have, who are not even going to bother to ask you, what is your job actually like? What is, what are the emotions around the decisions that you make to do it, the effect that it has in your relationship? They just jump immediately to all kinds of things that are all kinds of moral judgments and sense that that this is anathema, that this is something that they have to distance themselves from, that they want to distance their loved ones from, that you must be a that you as a sex worker must be a corrupting force, or that you've been so corrupted that you need to be saved, or and that even in that, even in that state of perceived vulnerability to the evils, the perceived evils, that you might be a corrupting force because they don't want their loved ones to be dragged down with you. So people, you know, people see these movies and they have a powerful, these movies like Hot Girls Wanted, they have a powerful effect on their view of what the sex industry is really like, and then they project that onto you instead of actually listening to your real human subjective story. So my hope would be that movies that are actually created by people in the industry on their terms, telling the stories that they want to tell, that that might have an influence on it, that it might at the very least complicate people's narrow ideas of what it actually means to be a pornographer, to perform in porn, to be a sex worker.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope people kind of allow space to kind of accept that narrative, because I think it is really, I think it's really hard sometimes. I think to have the, it becomes so polarized that when you want to kind of talk about something different, that people are like, well, you're just ignoring like all of this other stuff and basing, you know, this like the, what do they call it? Oh, the happy hooker sort of narrative. And
right.
Then you're ignoring all of this other stuff. And I, you know, I think with what we're trying to do here is I think we're trying to kind of show the complexity that is our lives, that it is, you know, I do this work, but I also do a lot of other things. And, you know, this work is not what defines me as a person, as a human being. You know, we are going through, you know, a lot of transition in our lives. You know, my partner is finishing her master's degree. Mm. Like, we are in a state that is not our home state to, you know, kind of facilitate that. I am going through kind of transitions in my career as someone who has been performing for a while and is now looking to kind of move on from that a little bit and kind of take a step back and be more of a creator of content and less of a performer, and kind of what that means for me and kind of changing things up in order to, for us to both prepare as you know, being parents as well.
Yeah.
And what that means for, you know, our economic stability and how we have been making money before and how that changes and how we kind of continue. And so there's a lot. We've kind of been joking that like, oh man, we like had this baby. It's a really good plot point.
you know, nice work.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the, And it's complicated, you know. It is. It's really difficult to when I think about the decisions I made around choosing to do sex work. I was thinking in terms of myself and how it affects my life, and not thinking about, you know, it was just 3 years before I even met my wife, so I didn't know that, you know, this person even existed or would be, you know, someone I would want to be for the rest of my life. So, you know, those decisions didn't kind of take that into account and how this would affect her life and her family. And, you know, I was, you know, very clear from the beginning, like, this is what I'm doing, this is what I'm going to continue to do. And this is, you know, if this is, you know, if this is something that you can support, and this is something, you know, we can, you know, make this relationship work. Very upfront about that. I didn't ever want it to be something that was a surprise or, and people, I think often, I know other people who have been asked by like fans or people on the internet, like, oh, does your partner know this is what you're doing? And it also seems like very, very crazy that, you know, that somebody would be hiding this whole other self. But yeah. People have before, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, it is sort of shocking to me, or I can't even wrap my mind around how you could be doing something and not, that you could be performing in porn, or that you could be an escort or a dominatrix or a stripper or a cam model and be, you know, have a partner, have a girlfriend or boyfriend, and be building intimacy with that person and not trust them with that information. At the same time, part of what we're talking about right now is the extreme lengths that stigma can push people to, that people would excommunicate and ostracize their loved ones, their grown children, you know, their family members, just because of an association with porn. And I can kind of understand in light of that why someone might choose to compartmentalize, or might have, you know, have so much association, you know, being socialized to think of porn in that way, that they would have like a lot of internal horror phobia, mm-hmm. as we say, that they would just be like, oh, this person won't really love or trust me or be able to handle this because I've seen the horrible things that horror phobia makes people do. So I'm going to keep it compartmentalized and separate in order to protect them or protect the relationship or protect myself. I respect people's rights to make that decision, but I also would like to help to contribute a world where people don't have to feel that way. I mean, it's sort of analogous to being out as queer, right? Like, I want to be like, yeah, throw glitter everywhere and be radical honesty. And of course you should be out to everyone. We need everybody to be out every second, all the time. Like, I do actually feel that way, especially the glitter part. But I also am very aware of all of the circumstances and conditions in which somebody might choose not to be out as trans or out as bisexual or out as gay. And I have to respect everybody's right to make that decision for themselves.
Yeah, yeah, because it's not, for so many people, it's not safe.
Yeah, it's really not safe. And, you know, there are certainly physical threats or threats to your stability, like your ability to, like, keep your housing or keep a different, you know, another job that you might have, or keep custody of your kids, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's also just emotional safety. You know, sometimes it seems like this part of me is stigmatized and demonized and people don't understand it and people don't even want to try to understand. So I'm just going to keep it a secret and keep it separate because I'm not prepared or equipped to deal with the emotions of that. And yeah, and then as you've seen, it doesn't get any easier when radical honesty doesn't always make things emotionally easier.
Yeah. And I think also the question of like, who is that radical honesty for? What does that always serve everyone involved in that situation? And, you know, we, over the years, my wife and I, we had many conversations about what to tell them, when to, you know, her family, what to tell them, when to tell them, how much to tell them. Do we even need to tell them? And that was, you know, a question that kind of came up a lot. Like, do we feel some sort of need for absolution by like coming out and like letting people know, like, this is what we do, even though we know that the result might be something that is really difficult and may never be understood. Is that a reasonable assumption to make for someone else in general? How much do they need to know? Do they even need to know that at all? Does that kind of change who we are, who we need to be in our interactions with them? There, you know, many people, I'm sure, in your life where like the details of their sexuality and their sex lives like aren't necessary in order for your relationship to continue and grow and for...
It's very appropriate to have boundaries around what you talk about in the specifics of your sexual identity. And this is another way that queerness is, and kinkiness too, actually, is analogous to sex work in terms of stigma, in terms of being out, because sex work, kink, queerness are so shrouded in mystery. And it's a little chicken and egg, like, does the mystery come first or the stigma come first? But because they're so shrouded in mystery, when you say to someone, like, if I say to someone that I'm gay, there's more of an acute sexuality to that assertion of my identity than if I was to say to someone that I was straight, or that if someone were to identify as straight or say that they were straight, right? Because that's sort of like the unmarked state, as it's called, right? Like whiteness or heterosexuality or being cisgender, or I guess in this case, like, not being a sex worker is like the unmarked state.
Yeah, the default value. And, yeah.
Right, exactly. But you can be out as queer and not be like rubbing butt sex in people's faces in every moment, right? You could be out as kinky. Like, I could come out to my parents as kinky, but not need to be like, well, mom, like, I'm really into spanking and being spanked, but like, I like am into pissing on people, but like not as into being pissed on like by men, but like with women, it's okay. Like, in these circumstances, right? Like, when you, if you talk to your parents about being sexually active, like, even if you are like a straight vanilla person, if you like talk about being sexually active, like, you don't need to be explicit with your parents. If you have that kind of relationship, like, I'm all for that. Yeah. But there are, and this really does come back to sex work in the sense that people assume that when you've crossed that boundary of making your sexuality public, making your body something that you like use commercially, making like a performance of sexuality or an intimacy something that you like negotiate the terms of for your livelihood, people assume that once you've crossed that boundary that you don't have the right to negotiate any other terms, or that you don't have any boundaries at all, which is, first of all, the opposite of true.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that that is where a lot of the source of stigma is that people hear that you're a sex worker and then they have a lot of fear and assumptions and projections and judgments that you are a boundaryless individual. And yeah, and that's ironic because that then you would be ostracized for that reason, when in fact I would say that the opposite is true. The fact that you have like crossed that taboo, crossed that threshold, means that you are learning how to negotiate all of those terms.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's you know, it's also kind of an interesting point when sometimes the product that you are selling sometimes through sex work is that sort of like boundaryless, like constantly like sexually engaged persona sometimes that is a product that people have a hard time kind of separating like the brand that you may put out there from the, I mean, there are things that I choose not to like represent in sex work. Like my sex work persona does not encompass all of my sexuality.
Totally.
It doesn't encompass like, you know, intimacy that like I may share with other partners I have in my life.
Yeah.
And it is, for me, is something that I have spent a lot of time, kind of crafting, kind of like whittling down to kind of feel like, what is this? What is Mickey Maude in terms of like the public presentation of Mickey Maude?
Yeah.
And the understanding of, I think, adult entertainment and that separation from like fantasy and reality is something that is really, really difficult for people to suspend their disbelief.
Yeah.
That is, there's something that happens that because the sex is real, because that, you know, because that is actually happening on some level, that people cannot separate this as an entertainment platform for people. I mean, and I don't feel that it's solely in the entertainment platform. And I think we could, I'm sure, talk for hours about kind of the philosophy of behind that, but it's often strange how, you know, I've participated in scenes that in my mind are clearly fictional scenes, and I've had people kind of like, you know, comment and ask if this, you know, is this real, or this really happened, or like, you know, like what is going on, or like, I think you're a bad and horrible person because this thing that I think is real that you did as a performance like happened.
Right.
And it's strange to me on how that is still such a, like, this is not new territory that we're getting into, but it's still a constant conversation.
What do you love about performing in porn?
I love being able to have a space where I can be vulnerable, where my body is not, actually does feels less personally threatened than it does in other areas of my life.
That's an amazing first point for you to hit as a man. I would say that's, you know, I think that being able to, that the fact that vulnerability is one of the first things that you think of when you think about making porn really flies in the face of what a lot of people, why the motivations that I think a lot of people have about why a man would choose to be a porn star, for example.
I also think it's for me, I know it's tied to being a black man in this, in this world. And, growing up thinking that like that I was somehow out of the realm of blackness in terms of what the media, what the images of black masculinity were presented to me, and growing up kind of feeling like, oh, well, maybe I'm not, you know, this like masculine person. Like I am not like, I feel that you see either like kind of this like hyper masculine sort of like thuggish representation, or you see, for me personally, it was important to portray like living brown bodies.
Yeah.
Because it's not something that like, you see, or when you do see it, it's done in a specific way that like, I didn't see from adult entertainment. I didn't see from mainstream entertainment, like people who were doing the things that I wanted to do were expressing the sexuality that I felt was represented of me.
Like what, for example?
I didn't see anybody who looked like me in any sort of like, you know, I had, you know, from my early 20s, like a fascination in BDSM and, and like specifically like, you know, sexual like role play.
Mm.
And it was often, I think, times presented to me as this sort of like luxury commodity of a certain group of people of a certain socioeconomic class. And, you know,
that's certainly the image that we see.
Yeah. And as you know, in growing up in San Francisco, as I met people who were in the BDSM community, people who like, you know, brought me into the BDSM community, that was, you know, there was the perception I had, and then like the reality of people who were not what I, you know, saw being presented. And when I got the opportunity to perform, that was something that was, you know, I knew that was something like, oh, like, and even though there was a lot of times where it was really difficult, and I'm like, I'm the only person here that looks like me.
Yeah.
And,
meaning the only person of color on a porn set?
Yeah. Yeah. And I am well aware of how people of color are portrayed in the adult industry. And,
it's not always pretty.
No, it's not. And, that is something that has made, that I think has been the most difficult, part of it. Turning down work that I know would, maybe be better exposure for like companies that like, you know, have greater distribution, because of the type of content that they, do or have asked me to do, you know, not working for certain directors, not, working with other performers that have, kind of a casual stance on that sort of content because it is the work that they get.
By casual, you mean racist?
Yeah. The sort of casual racism stance that is so prevalent in adult entertainment. And I see that as such a you know, difficult choice that I feel privileged enough to have been able to say like no to things that I know other people feel that they haven't been able to or just can't because of the nature of the work sometimes being so feast or famine. You know, interracial pornography is something that is a favorite topic of mine to talk about. My favorite, I mean, annoying as fuck.
Yeah. About it's annoying that you still have to talk about it.
Have to talk about it.
Yeah.
That performers will sometimes ask for a higher rate for interracial, their first interracial, which in the context of porn means someone sleeping, working with a black man.
Right. So it's usually a white female performer performing with a black male performer.
Yeah.
That is what interracial means in porn. Like an Asian female performer performing with a black man.
It's
like
almost always black male. It's the consistent factor in that.
And like, so like a white male and a black woman is not interracial in genre-wise in porn?
Genre-wise, usually it isn't, although I know there's some people who kind of consider that. Generally, when it is two women performing, it's not much of an issue, but there seems to be this ongoing debate on whether that is racist or not, because
whether interracial as a genre is racist or not?
Yeah, whether like charging more is racist, or interracial as a genre is racist, or the decision to do it or not do it is racist based on the way that the content is presented. And specifically when it comes to choosing to do the scene and accepting more money, there's kind of this ongoing debate recently on whether this is racist, because it is a genre that has increased in popularity. Mm. And so it is akin to something like, you know, doing something like anal or a gangbang or something that, you know, requires a lot more energy to do. And people kind of want to go back and forth of like, well, like, I'm, you know, I'm in this business to make money. And like, if I'm going to make more money off of this, and then, you know, why not? This is not, you know, this is not race-based. This is just purely business sense.
Also, and the industry is racist and sexist and transphobic. Even just if we're going to specifically talk about these genre constructions,
yeah,
or the way that people, the roles that people are asked to portray, even if we did live in a world where everyone could agree that these are fictional fantasy archetypes, and that it's not necessarily a statement about the humanity of these individuals in general, but yeah.
And if, to just kind of like settle that, like, my personal opinion is,
yes,
like,
please,
if you are only giving that option to white women, then yes, that is racist.
Yeah.
When women of color are, if you're going to say that this is a thing, and if it only works a certain way, and those options are only given to not the people of color,
right,
yeah, that's gonna be a little racist.
Yeah.
If you know,
yeah, specifically economically disenfranchising people of color, especially women of color.
Because you're saying that, like, you can only make more money for this scene if you are white.
Yes. So what are we gonna do about it?
Let's burn the whole thing down. I mean, you know, I don't know what to do about it. And I think that's kind of a frustration I have, is that people oftentimes want to throw their hands up and be like, well, it's porn. What did you expect?
And I've heard
you say
that a lot.
I think it's severely limiting to not think of, you know, on both sides of it, people who are in porn and people who aren't in porn, to allow, to kind of constrict like an evolution of a medium. Because they're like, well, it's this, like, it's never going to get any better if people actually don't take it seriously. And, you know, conversation that I was having with Jiz is that, like, you know, the solution is not to stop making porn or to make less porn. It's that more people need to be making, more people who haven't been making porn before need to be making porn.
Yeah.
You know, people who don't see themselves in it need to be making it. People who only see themselves in it in a certain way need to be making it. And I don't really feel that that's the case. I think it's like, you know, things have kind of been saturated, and things are really in a space where people feel that, like, oh, this is the way it is, I have to follow suit. And I don't think that was the case when, you know, certain people own the means of distribution, but I think, you know, the landscape is changing, and people are trying to scramble and find ways to, like, make money because the old system does not work. And if you have a video camera and an internet connection, like, you can be making content, and in a matter of time, like, you can be making better and better and better content. Like, and I think we need to kind of hold ourselves, like, accountable to making better content that doesn't make people feel like shit.
And I think that the folks, the amateurs, if you will, you know, the folks who just are, you know, making porn with the little film studio in their pockets, right, their phones, need to have education about how the distribution, privacy, monetization, marketing, how they can actually do that in an effective and sustainable way. Because I don't know, I am really frustrated by the dichotomy of amateur porn that people don't expect anyone to pay for is like more real or like less degrading to women or less degrading to people of color. And I think that that is really horphobic, right? Because there are, you know, sex workers and pornographers are out here, you know, trying to make a living and participating in this economy and the supply and demand, right? And mm-hmm. so this like sanctimonious idea of, you know, porn that like if that it's like more real or pure if you don't expect to get paid for it is bullshit. Yeah. But that's another axe that I have to grind. Yeah. But I think it's related.
Yeah.
Because who gets to make that? Anyway. You know, your argument about porn, like, well, what do you expect? It's porn, reminds me of some of the ongoing conversations, but like one in particular that has come up lately is the one about Ghost in the Shell, right? Like, oh well, we have to cast Scarlett Johansson in this role that is based on a beloved story that should really have a protagonist who is a woman of color. And people are like, well, in order for it to make money overseas, ironically, we need it there to be a recognizable movie star. And oh, I guess like all of the bankable movie stars are these like certain kinds of pretty white ladies. And
that we've made into movie stars.
So, you know, the question is, at what point does that justification about the bottom line, which in some ways I respect that this is not all just about ideology, it is about business, like porn is a business, and people do need to take these things into consideration. But at what point are you being a savvy business person, and at what point are you looking for a justification of your bigotry that you can point to the bottom line and be like, well, we've never tried it, so we have no example of what it would look like.
And the assumption that like people would be turned off by not having a Scarlett Johansson in this film.
Yeah.
Like that you can't wrap your head around if Scarlett Johansson is not in this film, people, not because she's white, like,
yeah,
like people are making a decision, well, if we put a person of color in here, people won't want to watch it.
I don't know those people.
I mean, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
yeah. And it's like this idea of that there is a baseline to human sexuality that at the end of the day, straight men are attracted to Jenna Jameson and gay men are attracted to, I don't know, Kobe Keller, and that women are hot for, I don't know, like who's like a male porn star that is like sort of like the prototypical like sexy male porn star
right now? I don't know. Say Ryan Driller. Like
he, yeah.
I feel like he's,
yeah, or even like right like now. Channing Tatum, to like use a like to use a movie star example, and yeah, that this idea that like ultimately at the end of the day, when you like strip past political correctness, like that's what people want. Fuck that, man. Like people are desirous of as many different things as you could possibly portray. And the like Jenna Jameson type is just a type that is to certain people's taste, but it's not like, she's not like this idea of like empirical attractiveness, I think is really limiting.
Well, I think also just like the star power marketing really is, I think, does a disservice to storytelling. Like if you're marketing, you know, that this star, this performer is in this movie or this, you know, adult film, are you've kind of thrown story at the window. Like you aren't. And it's just a little too much, you know, if you can't cut a trailer for a compelling story, you don't have a compelling story. And so like you are now passing off the responsibility of this product out there onto this star. So then it's like that Scarlett Johansson movie sucked. I'm like, well, it sucked regardless of who would have been in it.
Right.
But because you didn't create a story that was compelling, because you didn't create a product that people wanted to see, like, yes, you can enjoy Scarlett Johansson's, like, performance. How many times have I said Scarlett Johansson in this conversation?
Way too many times.
I think it's lazy. I think it's really lazy, you know, when people do that in adult and mainstream entertainment. And I understand that, like, you see someone's performance and you're like, you know, it connects and it resonates with you. But I think to be reliant on, you know, to say someone is consistent, like, all the time is, I don't think, factually true, or to say, like, you can only have this work if a certain person is in it. And there have been things that, like, you know, you've seen, you're like, I can't imagine this film, like, could you imagine The Shining with, like, not Jack Nicholson? You know, could you imagine, but had it been made with not Jack Nicholson, like, you might have still enjoyed the movie the same way. There's no way of really knowing.
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, you really, really get lazy when you market things that are just so tied to, like, this person is in it, and so this is what we're selling.
Yeah, get your credit card out. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for talking to me about that. Delicate subject. I hope we solved that social problem forever.
Yeah, on to the next one. Androids
and a lot can happen in 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're doing last-minute holiday shopping, you should know that the Pleasure Chest is offering a December gift card deal. When you spend $100, you get a $15 gift card. When you spend $150, you get a $25 gift card. That's when you spend up to $1,000 in store and $250 online. So what I think is, buy vibrators and fetish outfits and bondage gear and porno and safer sex supplies for your loved ones, and then pocket that free money to treat yourself to some post-holiday stress relief. If you're in New York City, Chicago, or LA, get thee to one of the brick-and-mortar stores or shop online from anywhere on earth at pleasurechest.com. Now, back to the show. Since porn was the thing that brought you and me together as friends, I was hoping that for posterity, you will tell the story of the night that we met.
I would love to, which is, as you know, one of my favorite stories.
I really do. Every time we get together, if someone has not heard the story, or maybe even if they have, you always want to tell it. So.
Yeah.
And I can't really tell it without you. I feel like we have to tell it together.
It's a good co-story. But, you know, in the times of the early years, or the years of, of our...
the halcyon days of queer porn, when there was, like, some money in queer porn in the Bay Area. And so, like, every hoe and, like, professional exhibitionist got to, like, make a few hundred bucks for, like, fucking their friends on camera the way that they wanted to fuck them. And then giving interviews about, like... bisexuality or whatever.
Yeah, it's good times. Good times.
Hey, listen, made me who I am today.
Yeah, we. I mean,
so this is like circa 2010, like
yeah, 2010, like 2009, somewhere
yeah,
in there. We both of us got cast. I forget sometimes that there was a third person in that scene.
There was. She is lovely. She was great. But she also was a little bit, like, we were cast as kind of a threesome. The idea was that it was for, like, a bisexual movie directed by Madison Young, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, it was you and me and another performer named Billy. And as was the sort of standard in those days of, like, consciousness raising porn, I can't believe that it feels like history now. We we were encouraged slash proactive about like getting together before the shoot and like getting to know each other a little bit, right? So we like met at the bar like 2 days before the shoot, right? Yeah. What bar was it?
It was in the Mission. It was the Uptown.
The Uptown.
The Uptown. Actually, still one of my favorite bars.
Is it still there?
It's still there, yeah.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny that it's such a novel idea of like
I know.
People meeting before they have sex more than 45 minutes ahead of time.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, we met. We had a great time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about Prince like a whole lot.
Obviously. R.I.P.
Which, you know, whether... I'm not exactly sure if we talked about Prince, but I feel like it's been such a running conversation in our friendship throughout the years that like it wouldn't surprise me if we did not talk about Prince.
We still do need to make that Triple X Purple Rain yeah. with you as Morris Day.
Motherfucking time. And we obviously we hit it off very well.
Obviously.
And as we were exiting the bar, and we decided to make out at the place where your bike was parked. A very San Francisco staple scene, I feel, is making
also the
out.
Way that you said, like, decided, like, we deliberated for a while and, like, we decided to make out. It was like, no, I think probably you just kissed me.
That's possibly what happened, yeah.
I allowed it to happen.
Regardless.
Anyway, so
we're
making out on the street corner.
Out.
Right. And then, no, go on. You tell this part
okay.
of the story.
We're making out on the street corner, and this gentleman walks by, and you had your bicycle helmet in hand.
I think maybe I had started to unlock my bike.
Yeah.
And I had, like, taken out my helmet, but then we were, like, making out some more before I rode away.
Yeah. And this man was very impressed that you were, as he put it, damn, girl, kissing brothers on the street, and you ride a bike? And I wasn't sure what he was more impressed or surprised by, but I just thought it was like,
it was pretty comical.
Yeah,
it was instant comic gold.
Instant gold, yeah.
And then we fucked.
Yeah.
And and then the rest is history.
Yeah.
And now here we are, 10 years later.
That's how friendships nearly. Are formed in San Francisco.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I totally hear what you're saying about the fact that the porn industry does have a race problem, a sexism problem, has a transphobia problem. In some cases, porn perpetuates some of the worst language and ideologies and concepts about people, different kinds of people. And you definitely have dealt with that with regards to gender and race and other things, I'm sure, as well. So how do you reconcile those parts of the industry with the parts of the industry that have given you so many opportunities and that has motivated you to stick with it for almost a decade, which is quite a lot longer than the average person?
I think I've been really lucky.
Yeah.
I think I've been really lucky to work for companies that, you know, see my value as a performance as not, you know, we need black guy A here, who have... You know, and not every company that I've worked with has, you know, been that way, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, sometimes like you have to kind of pick your battles, and there are definitely like, you know, scenes and companies that I've shot for where I'm just like, you know, I don't feel, you know, super great about this, and this is not like what I the content that I feel like is representative of like what I'd like to see out there, but it's okay. And I understand for some people that they need that. And, you know, I need to pay my bills as well. And just like, you know, every other job where you're like, you know, this day wasn't so great, but whatever, you know, tomorrow's a different day. You know, you make those choices because you need to pay your bills. Yeah. I mean, I think that I've been really lucky that I started out in BDSM and fetish content, even though there, you know, are places within that genre that are highly racialized and problematic in other ways. I felt that I was kind of able to do a little bit more because of being in BDSM, where the focus was more on a dynamic and not as who I was physically.
Awesome.
Yeah.
When I hear stories like yours with your partner's family excommunicating you both specifically as a result of the fact that you perform in porn, and I try to wrap my mind around it, I always come back to a confusion about why, just on a simple, on the simplest, most fundamental level, you're having sex, you're an adult, you're having sex, people are filming it, you're negotiating the terms of getting paid for that performance, the end. That's it. Why? Like, what do you think your wife's parents and family think about you and this work that is so repugnant, so awful, so immoral, that they have to completely cut you both out of their lives without even a conversation?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about that and a lot of speculation, because without that conversation, there's no way to actually know. And
that's number one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And, you know, as I've gotten to know them over the years, and, you know, one thing I will say is when, and I'm sure you can kind of relate to this or know, you know, kind of this sort of situation, is when you're in spaces where you're not out and, you know, the topic of work comes up, like everybody has like a cover story or a distortion of, you know, events and situations that make it easier to kind of like interact when people are kind of like sharing about like, oh, what do you do for a living at, you know, so-and-so's like holiday party or,
sure. And sometimes it's because you are not in the mood to offer instant sex advice to the person that you just met. Because again, people assume that if you have transgressed that boundary, that you
have
are a boundaryless person. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which, untrue for the record.
Yeah. I will say over the years of getting to know them, one of the things that I think is just hard for people in general is, and when you have shame about something, when you have a feeling that something should not be discussed or talked about or put into public, to see someone else do that thing that you have intense feelings about it not being out in public, I think that there's a repulsion.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there is a lot of difficulty with communicating around sex and sexuality in America in general.
Yeah, I would say the world.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my wife's family is not, they're not very conservative. They're not very religious. They're not very political. The feeling that I get that like is most painful for me is that it's presented as something that my wife did to hurt them. That it's like, oh, well, you've always been like a troublemaker, or you're always like rocking the boat. You're like a social justice warrior trying to get us to think different. And I've seen that, you know, through being with her and being with her and her family, and you know, topics coming up and having discussions, really awkward discussions about Black Lives Matter, about law enforcement, about the justice system, about reproductive rights, you know, these things that, you know, we care about, and these topics where our opinions are very different. And, you know, I, even though we don't agree, like, we're able to have, there's always been a difficulty in having the discourse about it. And I think, you know, me and my wife really want to have that discourse, and not to change people's minds, although, like, some, in some cases that would be great. That would be fantastic in some cases, but just also to, like, understand. And and for me, the, I think the complete, if you thought that what we do is so horrible, is so, creates such this, like, visceral negative response, and your child was with a person that, like, you thought was, like, and I don't know if they think that I'm the embodiment of, like, all evil in the world. I, you know, and I know that there's, like, you know, a part of the level of, like, the secrecy, and then, like, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you trust us with this information?
I mean, because of the way you're reacting right now. I mean, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But
like, we hate you so much. Why didn't you bring this up before?
So you could hate us earlier. I, you know, I don't know. But the, like, if this is something that, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like one, it's kind of like a denial of my, like, wife's capability to, like, make decisions or defend her decisions, or to that this was a, like, an attack on, like, the family, to, like, hurt them or distance, you know, like, they're, it seems like they're, the perception, I kind of have this feeling that perception of decisions made were kind of, like, selfish and childish, to, like, distance herself from the family. And the, for me, what's kind of stands out is this lack of, this feeling of the lack of, like, care and concern. Like, if you thought that your child was involved with something that you obviously feel very strongly enough to consider not talking to somebody. And there was no, like, are you okay?
Yeah, man.
And that for me was, is kind of a big, is a big thing. There is, you know, a large amount of, like, pain and guilt that I carry on this feeling. And I've, you know, many people have tried to tell me, like, you know, you can't take this on. Like, you didn't, like, ruin her relationship with her family. You didn't ruin, like, her life. But it's hard not to feel, to feel that way when you see your wife's family choosing not to communicate with her anymore because of something that you chose to do. And
but also, you guys have always been honest with each other, and so she also chose to be with you. And I don't mean that in the sense that we were talking about before, of, like, she chose to bestow her benevolent grace upon you and love you despite these horrible things that you do. Like, you guys love each other. You guys decided to make a lifelong commitment to one another. You guys are having a kid. You love each other as you are. And it's really, really sad when people can't even, when people have so much shame, it says, you know, you use the word shame, that that clouds their ability to see that this is fundamentally about the kind of love that she has and the kind of family that she is making for herself.
Yeah. Yeah. And that there's, I think, something to kind of be, I don't know if thankful is the right word, but there's something about this situation that has really, you know, we were already kind of having the conversation about like what our values are as in terms of like the family that we're, you know, creating. And I think this has been also a time of having real clarity about the way that we communicate things, about the way that we kind of see ourselves in the world, because, you know, with this situation, I've had to kind of like, you know, been more aware of my own like internalized, like, you know, whorephobia and like my own internalized like sex work stigma of like fighting and having these moments of like doubt and being like, well, what if they're right? What if, like, you know, this is everything that, like, you know, people have been talking about is right? And then realizing that, like, you know, like the shames that, like, we all have, like, we can choose to deal with it, we can choose to kind of face it, we can choose to confront it, or we can choose to ignore it. And I don't think that ignoring it does anybody any, it's, I think it's a Baldwin quote of like, you know, not all problems can be solved, but for a problem to be solved, it has to be faced.
Yeah.
And
nice.
Yeah. I know. He's great.
He knew what the fuck he was talking about.
Fuck. Yeah. And that's, you know, I think that it's so backwards in this country to, you know, talk about the, you know, proliferation of like porn on the internet and its like negative and detrimental effects, but we can't actually talk about sexual education and sexual health and rape culture to people who are, you know, facing it day to day. Like, we can't talk about that. We can't have transparency in the conversations about sex and sexuality, but it just seems so backwards.
Well, the stigmas are established so that in order to produce and replicate shame, so that we're all doing the work of keeping powerful people powerful and powerful people in control of, literally in control of sex and who gets to have it and what kind they get to have and what kinds are criminalized and what kinds are accepted and normalized as moral and acceptable and legal. Mm-hmm. And these strong reactions that people have to finding out that people that they love or the people in their communities or their families or their, that those people have transgressed those rules, people start freaking out. I mean, it's like what you were saying about, it is the same as a conversation about Black Lives Matter or a conversation about police brutality. People have been contributing to this way of life that, and maybe going against their instincts, like, well, I don't know if I necessarily believe this, but I have to contribute to this system so that I can get mine, so that I can have safety, so that I can have securities. And so then when they see that transgress, they're like, well, God damn it. Like, I think that somewhere deep inside, they're like, well, why have I been putting up with this? And this person is just like flagrantly flying in the face of it. Like, I'm going to be mad at them because this is something concrete. This is someone that I can blame for my pain at the sacrifices that I have had to make in order to contribute to a patriarchal, heteronormative, capitalist society. And that's part of how those things replicate themselves and keep themselves strong. So you're fighting it, and it's really painful for you guys right now, and it's going to be painful for a while. Yep. In some ways it will always be painful.
I don't know what a resolution looks like, and I'm not going to be naive and say like, oh, they'll come around, you know, and
they might.
Yeah. And there might be times later down the line where it's somebody in my family or somebody else that we know that, you know, has a hard time with, the decisions that we've made.
It might be your kid, your future kids.
Yeah.
You might go through a period where they're learning their place in the world, and they have a hard time contextualizing, you know, your past or maybe even the things that you're still doing in their lives.
Yeah. And that's their right to do so. I just hope that, you know, at the very least we can talk about it. And that is, I think the thing that is so difficult is the lack of communication, is that if you'd just rather it go away sort of feeling. And that's what I feel is being communicated, is that like, well, this way we don't have to deal with it at all.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure they're dealing with their own kind of pain, and they want to punish you guys. They feel they need this space in order to come to a conclusion where they can reconcile and figure out how to have a relationship. Mm-hmm. I wish that they could have communicated that to you, because there's nothing wrong with needing space.
Yeah.
But if it's framed as excommunication, then that's just going to cause you guys anguish.
Yeah.
What is the number one piece of disinformation out there about what it means to be a porn performer? If you could disavow the world of that disinformation in a way that could potentially contribute to healing this pain that you have in your family, what would it be?
Just one.
You can you can do top three if you want.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
There is a lot. And I understand everybody's experience is different for people who choose to perform. And I feel that there is no like universal reason that people choose this work. I think that is in the conversations I've had with people in articles that get written, and you see people respond in the comments section. Ugh. And people will throw out like, well, they're only doing this because of like fill in the blank, you know, they don't have any other choice because they're uneducated or X, Y, and Z, or you know, they're brainwashed and don't have any choice to begin with. That there is so like, I think it's so easy for people to want to just point to like a reason why people do this. And there's not like one reason.
No.
You know, there's so many multifaceted reasons, and there's the people who are in this work are as diverse as the range of human sexuality and don't see that there's anything wrong. I think that is the kind of the connecting thing, is they don't see that the expression of their sexuality is anything to be ashamed of. And I think the disinformation is that there is like just like one way to go about presenting that. And that there's only like a certain type of person who does this work. I mean, I you know, we've met people from all backgrounds, all like a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and religious, etc.
Yeah.
Who really do love and enjoy this work. And also people who try it out and don't like it.
Yeah.
And
they're not tainted forever by that choice.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's the forever tainting.
Yeah.
Is something that we need to kind of get the fuck over.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, Mickey Maude, I think you're an amazing porn star. I think the world is better for you taking your pants off and fucking for money on camera. And I'm glad that you have chosen to do it. I'm grateful that sex work and porn, particularly in the Bay Area, created a community for people to meet and fuck and then become friends.
Yeah.
Lifelong friends.
Yeah.
And in a way, that bond is so strong because of all of the stigma that we face. Like, we gotta band together and take care of each other and listen to each other and be there for each other, because if we don't, no one else will. And you know that you and your wife always has that community to support you, and we know what you're going through, and we're never going to judge you. We'll not even judge you if you become like non-sex worky normal people with a baby. Thanks for sharing all of this really heavy stuff with me today.
I think that's something that, you know, we were going to talk about. I think it's without the support of community, without feeling like there are other people out there who have, you know, been through similar, and I know there are more people out there who are dealing with this and having trouble with it. I think one of the things that's kind of saved us is so many people who in our lives, you know, who have done sex work, who haven't done sex work, have been so supportive. And there is community out there for everyone. And it might not have been who you thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
But it is who it is.
Well, good luck with your movie.
Thank you.
All your movies. And you want to go swimming?
Yeah, let's go swimming.
Hell yeah.
All right.
All right. I love you.
I love you too.
Talk more soon. Locations. Interrobang is produced and hosted by yours truly, Tina Horn. Our theme music is by my brother from another mother, Moot. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.